How do you develop your gifts if you have no opportunity? I can't conceive of not having an opportunity. You want to explain that? How would you not have an opportunity?
One man takes up all the time.
Oh, you mean in the assembly? That's just such a minor part of life. Yeah, okay, you're in the wrong assembly, Marvin said. Maybe you should go someplace else where you can develop. I think, in a sense, Christians are like water, and we seek our own level. And you ought to go where you can not only give the most, but do the best. But the assembly is such a minor part of life. Any gift that you have that could be developed within the assembly can be developed out of the assembly, I think. You're not convinced. Bob?
Don't you think that possibly we've gone to the extreme of thinking about speaking almost in the same way that the Corinthians did speak in tongues?
Sure.
Clear out the point.
Yeah. I doubt that the Jews, who were the first ones in the church, had speeches in the way that we do now. I can't prove it for sure, but we know that this was not their common manner. They would be much more likely to be doing the type of thing that we're doing in a class. Oratory was the Greek influence that came in later on. And Origen was credited with being the father of the sermon. He was one of the presidents of the school of preaching, the school of Christianity. It started down in Alexandria, Egypt, which the historian Mosheim called the grave of primitive Christianity. The sermon, as such, is not a part of the New Testament, although certainly there is a place for discourse. But yeah, I think we've overemphasized it. And I've been saying that for 15 years, but I don't think people believe me. Anne?
Even in class, there are many different types of teachers, and there are some that are orators.
Sure.
That are doing the teaching.
Right.
And there are many methods that can be used, and that's up to the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you could look at it from that angle, and it isn't that it's a wrong method, but it isn't always the appropriate method.
Lecturing is usually the least effective method, but it is good for conveying a given amount of information in a short time. And it takes about three times as long to discuss something as it does to lecture about it. So there's a place for all of this, but I don't think we should be so married to the speech. And there are signs that we're beginning to get away from that now and be more imaginative about the methods that we might use to convey the same content. We have to take a break now for 10 minutes. We were talking in the 14th chapter of 1 Corinthians, and I think we had about wrapped up what we needed to say there. There is another point or two that maybe we ought to look at. We had gotten down to verse 29 and had talked about it. Let the prophet speak two or three, and let the other discern. And then I was about to make the point in verse 30. If anything be revealed to another that sitteth by, let the first hold his peace. The expression hold his peace can be used in two ways in English. One is, let the first be quiet. But the other is, let the first finish until he is quiet. A slightly different variation of thought there. And that seems to be what's indicated here, as elsewhere in the New Testament. You remember in the 15th chapter of the book of Acts, in the assembly that the apostles and elders had in Jerusalem, somebody was talking, Paul and Silas, I guess, wasn't it? It was Paul and Barnabas that were talking there. Anyway, it says that when they held their peace, then somebody else took over and said a little more. That doesn't mean that they caused them to stop talking before they were finished, but it means that they allowed them to finish before they started talking. 13th verse, yes. Paul and Barnabas, yes. And after they had held their peace, James answered, saying, men and brethren, hearken unto me. And so it doesn't mean that you would force a prophet to stop talking and say, hold your peace, I've got a revelation from God here, because he was already giving a revelation from God. So even if you were smitten, stricken, or enlightened, I don't know how it's, what word you would use to describe it, with a revelation from God. The spirits of the prophets were subject to the prophets. And you could go ahead and keep still until that person finished their message, and then you may all prophesy one by one, that all may learn, that all may be comforted. The spirits of the prophets are subject to the prophets, for God is not the author of confusion, but of peace, as in all the churches of the saints. There was something mentioned to me yesterday about verse 2. Verse 4, I'm sorry. He that speaketh in an unknown tongue edifieth himself. I had said yesterday that I thought that the speaker in an unknown tongue probably did not know what he was saying, else he would be able to interpret, and that he would edify himself not through the words he was speaking, but through the fact that he knew that this was a message from God and a gift from God that he was exercising, and this in itself would be an upbuilding thing. I was talking to Brother Richard Riggins afterward, and he said that because of the structure of language, he felt it would be possible for the tongue speaker to know what the message was that he was delivering, because he would be thinking in that language and yet be unable to transfer this into another language. So to know what he was saying but still be unable to interpret it. And I can see that. I hadn't thought of it in that way before, but I can understand that. Also, down in verse 13, wherefore, let him that speaketh in a tongue pray that he may interpret. This would seem to indicate that it would be possible in some cases for a tongue speaker to be able to interpret that himself. And that is something that I had not thought of either. So I think those things are worth throwing into the cauldron here as we discuss it. Now, is there anything else that somebody wanted to say about this before we move on? Yes, sir.
Tongue is a language, isn't it?
Yes, sir. Tongue is a language.
So if a person was speaking here at the congregation this morning in German language or Italian, it'd just be wasted.
Yes, sir. That's right. Is that you, Otto?
That's me.
Okay, I hadn't seen you for a long time and I didn't recognize you for sure. Good to have you here today. Anybody else? Marvin.
I think this 13th verse also implies, you brought out the other day, that if I have one gift that's partly dependent on another gift, that I ought to pray for both of them. And I don't believe the Apostle Paul means in the 14th chapter of Corinthians that we ought not to desire, or they ought not to desire, these other gifts as well as speaking in tongues.
Right. I think you're right.
It's the priority that they're placing on this objective.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be more of a show if you can speak in tongues than if you can have the gift of knowledge.
Right.
For example. Although I don't see, I can't hardly sort that out, because it seems to me like speaking in tongues is about the lowest level of the gift, if I'm reading
yes.
right.
I think that's true.
Choosing the sandwich for a steak, really.
Okay, Carter?
Comment on the use of the word unknown. Is that the
In which verse now?
13th.
The 13th verse? No. It's not only not in the original, but it shouldn't be in here at all, because it's just confusing. It's, of course, any tongue is unknown if you don't understand it, but it's known someplace. Otto? Okay, strange meaning foreign. Thank you. Okay, a tongue, and tongue is glossa, which is a language. Very good. Do you think... Oh, Tom, go ahead.
What would you say about the time in the Old Testament when Saul would send men after David and the Spirit came down and then prophesied? Could they help that prophesying, or was God... Is this a different type of instance altogether?
I think this is a little bit different, because in the case of Balaam, too, for instance, Balaam not only couldn't keep from saying the message that he was saying, if he was going to say anything, but he couldn't even stop it. Balak would say, well, if you can't prophesy what I want you to, just don't say anything. And he'd say, I can't stop. So that was definitely different, I think. Steve?
I didn't hear the reference in Acts.
Acts 15:13. When they had held their peace, which means when they had finished what they were saying. And I mention that because the expression hold your peace so often means to us, just be quiet right where you are, whether you're finished or not. And that's not what it means here, let the first hold his peace. It means let him finish. Okay, anything else? Do you think that if a person had one of these gifts, he would have to have another laying on of the apostolic hands to receive another gift? Lewis.
Well, the scripture says the Spirit divides as he will. When we limit the Spirit, if man receives a gift by the Spirit laying on the apostle's hands, we say then the Spirit, after he bestowed a gift, is inoperative.
That's possible
that he could move on bestowing.
I think that's a good thought because of what we read there in the 13th verse a minute ago. Let him pray that he may interpret. Not let him pray that an apostle visits the city again. So, I doubt that any one person had very many of these together, but they may have. Of course, the apostles had them all. But I mean anyone on whom the apostles had laid their hands. But evidently, it was possible to have more than one. Marvin, were you going to say something else?
Wouldn't that kind of negate the requirement of laying on the apostle's hands to receive the miraculous gift, if he could pray and get it without the apostles, even though he had one? Seems to be like you're taking some authority away from the apostle.
How then do you look at verse 13? Let him that speaketh in a tongue pray that he may interpret.
Well, I think it seems to me like that he could pray that he would receive the gift, but he would still receive it by the same method he got the first gift.
Okay.
Otherwise, you take it out of the apostle's hands, and I don't see that.
Okay. Carter? Well, I don't know. I haven't looked at that closely. But I don't think so. Because
he's asking it for himself.
Yeah, I think he's asking it for himself. Lowell?
What about responsibility if you're using the gift well, that you would be, you know, like a talent, you would be given more?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about what you would be given more, but we're wondering how you would be given it. Whether it be once the apostolic hands had been laid on you, would you then have the ability to get more of these possibly from the same Spirit who had bestowed the first one or not? And I don't know. I don't think we have enough information about this to tell for sure.
We don't have any example of anybody ever doing it.
Not to my knowledge. Was there a hand over here? Tom?
I had wondered about that verse too, and I wondered about that yesterday. I had heard the idea that it could possibly mean that if the man was not to pray unless it could be interpreted, and that was the thought rather than asking for it. But the way it's worded, it does look like he's asking, he's kind of in the pray that they themselves.
Mm-hmm. It looks like it. Otto?
Now you see the church at Corinth had all of them. If some different ones
sure.
had all the different gifts. And so if one couldn't, if he spoke in a different language, there would be another who could interpret what he was saying.
Right. Right. Do you think that it would be possible for a person to pray for the gift of interpretation even though he already had the gift of tongues, and interpret what he himself was saying? Okay. Do you think he would have to have another laying on of the apostles' hands to receive interpretation? Okay. Okay.
This is all for a purpose, you see.
Right.
Now, the apostles laid their hands on them, and they could receive these different gifts. But then the early church... This is all for the edifying and building up of the
right. Right. Okay, very good. We've brought both sides of this out, and you'll have to study it further on your own and see what you're going to make of this. As I said when we began to study this subject, since it's not available to us today, it's very difficult for us to tell just exactly how all this was done. Another question that Carter, go ahead. Okay.
How do you interpret what's written in the book that the listener gives when he says to one is given a gift, to another, another gift, to another, another gift, to another, another gift, and so on, all the way through there?
Yeah. Yeah, I understand that, but I don't know how to bring this into connection with chapter 14, verse 13, unless we say that it was possible, that generally it was not done. Usually a person would only have one, but that in some instances it would be possible. Otherwise, I fail to see why he would encourage someone to pray for it. And he does say at the end of chapter 12, covet earnestly the best gifts, which means desire or be zealous for the best gifts. I'm assuming that they would desire gifts then that they didn't already have. And in some cases, the people doing the desiring might have already had a gift. So we have to look at both sides of this, and it seems that it was possible, but that the usual was that you only had one. That's all I know how to make of it. Jerry?
Do we have any indication that once an interpreter, always an interpreter?
Okay, the question is, do we have any indication that once an interpreter, always an interpreter? I think that generally that would be true. However, these gifts evidently needed to be stirred up. They needed to be kept in use and in exercise. Like Paul said to Timothy in chapter 1, verse 6, stir up the gift that is in thee by the laying on of my hands. 2 Timothy 1:6. So evidently it had something to do with the volition of the individual to keep using this. And I guess it could probably have gotten a little bit rusty if you didn't. Whether it would be taken away, I'm not sure. If one apostatized from the faith, though, that might be likely. Ivan. It sounds like it the way it's written there in the King James, but really the expression severally there just means one's own. Dividing or distributing to every man one's own, as he will. Good point. Tom?
This could very well be accommodated language, just like we would say one brother is a capable speaker, another brother is a capable song leader, another brother is a capable something else.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that one cannot do more. I think of this just as accommodative language.
I think it has to be because of these other statements that he makes. We have to interpret each scripture in the light of all the other scriptures that we have. Okay.
The one gift that we can all have and we're supposed to have, and that's love.
The more excellent way. Since we haven't got it down like we'd like to have it, we better keep working on it instead of desiring these others. Okay.
And like and love is a language we can all understand.
The universal tongue.
That's right. And even an animal, you can show that you love it, and they can accept their reciprocation.
Okay. Thank you very much. Now that we've considered these gifts in the light of their first century application, we need to ask what happened to these gifts after the apostolic age. There's no question in anybody's mind who's here, I think, but what the apostolic church was a miracle-working church as a body. How long did this state of things continue on? There's something interesting that happens here as we look at the writings of the church, and it was an apostatizing church before very long, as you know. But the writings of that church through the next several hundred years, it's interesting to look at what's said about these spiritual gifts. There's little or nothing said about them, about the working of miracles, during the first 50 years after the apostolic era. Now, I'm limiting the apostolic era to about 100 AD, since that's when the Apostle John died, approximately, as I believe, at least. Some people think the book of Revelation was written before the destruction of Jerusalem. I don't. I think it was written very late, probably about 96 AD. And the Apostle John then was able to come back after Domitian died and Nerva took over. He was able to come back to Ephesus and live out his last few remaining days there as a crippled old man. And finally, he died. So the apostles were gone. The apostolic age was over. Now, for the next 50 years after that, say from 100 to 150 A.D., there is very, very little said about the workings of miracles in the church, in the writings of the people who were prominent in the church at that time. In the next 50 years, from 150 to 200 A.D., it is slight and rather unimportant, but it's growing just a little bit. In the next century, which would be the 3rd century, 200 to 300 A.D., it becomes more abundant. And then finally in the 4th century, it gets even more abundant and more precise. And it increases still more in the 5th century and then on beyond that. More and more talk about signs and miracles. This is a rather curious state of affairs if we believe what we've been saying about these being bestowed by the laying on of apostolic hands or only two people upon whom apostolic hands had been laid, even if the laying on of hands had occurred some time before. One of the interesting things about this is that these church fathers, so-called, and even the apostolic fathers who were very early, don't contain clear and certain allusions to miracle working or to the exercise of the charismatic gifts contemporaneously with themselves. They talk precisely about the New Testament miracles, but they don't talk that precisely about what was going on in their own day. In fact, so characteristic is this of them that when they do cite a specific miracle, it stands out like a sore thumb. There were some specific miracles recorded about the closing years of the life of Polycarp. I think you know who Polycarp was. Polycarp was a disciple or a student of the Apostle John. Polycarp and John probably knew one another a lot better than most of you and I know one another. They spent a lot of time together. And according to the historical traditions that we have from the early churches, the Apostle John appointed Polycarp to be an elder in the church at Smyrna. And some of the last, I think, authenticated miracles that we have occurring are from Polycarp. There are some in particular from about 147 A.D. Polycarp was martyred in 155 A.D. And it stands out like a sore thumb because they get real specific and tell exactly what happened there. Most of the rest of the time when these people are talking about miracles in their own day, if they do at all, they just refer to it in vague allusions that there are miracles in the churches and these kinds of things, but they don't tell you what they were. Now in the 4th century, as I already mentioned, there is an ever-increasing stream of these miracles, so-called, such as they were, without any of these writers claiming that he himself has worked a miracle, or without ascribing miracle working to any known name in the church, and without a single instance being recorded in detail. They just say that they're there. But they don't say, I did it. They don't say, he specifically did it. And they don't tell specifically what was done. In fact, Irenaeus is alone, almost, of the writers in this general time period in talking about raisings of the dead at all. The others don't even mention them at all. And what Irenaeus said about raisings of the dead is questionable. He speaks of them in a way that suggests, I think, that he is not talking about something happening in his lifetime, but in past instances. Eusebius, in his Ecclesiastical History, which was written sometime around the Council of Nice, 325. It wasn't all written at once, but it was compiled. It was a compilation and a transcribing of many documents that had been written before. And Eusebius then interviewed some other people and put this all together, known as the father of church history, as I think that you know. Eusebius narrates what he calls a very wonderful story that was told by Papias. Papias was another disciple of the Apostle John. When I use that word disciple, I just mean that he was following John as John followed Christ. He was kind of a protege of the Apostle John. Papias was another one of these, and this was a story. Eusebius quotes a story that was told by Papias, and Papias said that he was quoting it on the authority of the daughters of Philip. The daughters of Philip, as you know, were able to prophesy, and Papias was good friends with them. The point here is that Eusebius says, quote, he relates in his time, that is to say, that back in Papias' time, that one rose from the dead. And he may mean that this was happened in Philip's time. He may mean that it was in Papias' time. But I can see how this could transpire if he means that it was in Philip's time. He was talking about something that happened earlier. And the fact that he would call this such a wonderful story and such an amazing thing shows that the church was not claiming these kinds of things during this time. It was thought to be such a marvelous thing by them. And it's clear from reading Eusebius in its entirety that he was not familiar with raisings from the dead in his own day at all. And probably that Papias was not familiar with them in his day either. It's equally clear that Eusebius did not know of numerous instances of such things, even in the earlier history of the church, while he was in the act of transcribing these things. You'd think from the way a lot of people talk that these things just should have been in abundance all over the place, but they weren't if we look at these histories. Alan?
Is it possible that these miraculous gifts were waning even during the first century when the apostles were still alive?
Yes, I think it is possible.
I think of a couple of instances where Paul had close friends who, if he could have worked miracles in his own will, he wouldn't have left them then.
Sure. Yeah, I think that was true even in earlier days. That there was nobody who just went around healing every problem he saw. As we stated the other day, there were three basic purposes for miracles, and compassionate sympathy for people was not one of them. Now, if you were to enumerate a lot of instances, sure, they worked toward that end, but that wasn't even one of the primary purposes for miracles. Yeah, drink no longer water, take a little wine for your stomach's sake, and for your oft infirmities, Timothy. Trophimus have I left at Miletus sick. Epaphroditus got sick. Paul had a thorn in the flesh. This is a theme through the New Testament. And that's a good point that you bring up there, because it's not like a lot of people think it was. Marvin?
Were they ever allowed to use it for their own benefit or for just for compassion that you know of?
Not that I can think of. I can't think of them ever being allowed to use it that way. Of course, in one way, that question is kind of a trick question. I know you didn't intend it that way, but if we know about it, then that shows that the only purpose of it wasn't for that, because it's a testimony to us. So the very fact that we know about it excludes that possibility.
Otto? In the case of Paul had this affliction on every flesh, and he could have healed himself if he saw fit to use it, but he didn't do it. The Lord says, my grace is sufficient.
You mean you think he could have healed himself?
Well, yes, if we look at that, you see, but Paul didn't.
Yeah, we know he didn't. I don't think he could have. He besought the Lord three times for this.
Right, yes. But then we say if the apostles had all power, you see, why didn't he heal himself?
I just don't think he was able to exercise it every time he wanted to.
Then, I think that this went out when the last person on whom the apostles laid their hands died.
I do too.
And it was over.
I do too. And we don't know exactly when that was.
No.
But by the middle of the second century, it was pretty close to being over.
But the tongues business was easier to carry on, you see, because you could deceive people. Today, you can deceive people.
Right.
With that. But then you to raise somebody from the dead or something like that, why, you can't fool people like that.
That's right.
That person is paralytic or something that went and healed him right before everybody. Why, you can't fool people about that, but then you don't see that.
That's right. Yeah, we want to get into talking about modern day miracles or the things that pass for miracles in these days and talk about what differences there might be and what are we to say to people who claim to perform miracles. I think when we come to think of it, it's rather surprising that the early Christians had no raisings from the dead to point to throughout all these years that we've been talking about. The fact that they didn't is a rather striking testimony to their honesty and veracity, because the heathen all around them had these things in abundance. the heathen religions of every stripe and variety had resurrections from the dead, or what passed for that. In an age that was so innocent of real medical knowledge and so filled to the brim and overflowing with superstition, apparent death and resuscitation were frequently played upon, and as a rule were very important.